It meant she could go home and be with Sawyer. They would get married and move in together and raise their child. He could make her happy. He could make her better. She knew he could. He saw her. He was the only person who did. She called his house incessantly until she obviously wore the maid down. When Sawyer got on the phone, she was taken aback by his tone. "Julia, you have to stop calling here," he said brusquely.
I've missed you. Where have you been?"
Silence.
"This place is horrible," she went on. "They want to put me on medication."
Sawyer cleared his throat. "Maybe that's a good idea, Julia."
"No, it's not."
She smiled, thinking how wonderful this was going to be.
"It might hurt the baby."
Silence again. Then, "What baby?"
"I'm pregnant, Sawyer. I'm going to tell my therapist and then my dad. I should be home soon."
Wait, he said quickly. "What?"
"I know it's a surprise. It was for me, too. But don't you see? It's really the best thing that could have happened. I'll come home and we can be together."
"Is it mine?" he asked. She felt the first string tighten around her heart, thin and sharp.
"Of course it's yours. That was my first time. You were my first."
He waited so long to say something that she thought he'd hung up. "Julia, I don't want a baby," he finally said.
"Well, it's too late for that," she said, trying to laugh.
"Is it?"
"What do you mean?"
"I'm 16, he suddenly exploded. "I can't be a parent. And I'm with Holly. This is the worst thing that could happen to me right now. I have plans." A second string, then a third, tightened around her insides, making it hard to breathe.
"You're with Holly?"
She knew he'd been dating Holly, but she'd assumed, after what had happened on the football field, the way he'd looked at her and touched her. How could he do that to her and still be with Holly?
"I've always been with her. You know that. We're going to get married after college."
"But that night," he interrupted her, saying, "you were upset."
"It's not just the baby, then?" she almost whispered.
"You don't want me?"
"I'm sorry. I really am. I thought you knew."
"You thought I knew?" Her eyes started filling with tears and her breathing was heavy. She thought she might hyperventilate. He was supposed to save her.
"I'll take care of it," she said, turning to hang up the payphone.
Sawyer might not want the baby, but she did. She would take care of it by herself. Sawyer misunderstood.
"That's good. It's the right thing, Julia. I know it'll be hard, but it will be over before you know it. Just get an abortion and everything will be fine. Let me send you some money."
His voice was so nice now, so relieved. She felt a wave of hatred so strong that it popped off her skin and caused a crinkling noise in the phone receiver. An abortion? He wanted her to get an abortion? He didn't want the baby, but he didn't want her to have it either. How could she ever have thought she was in love with such a person? "No, I can do it by myself."
"Let me do something."
"You've done enough," she said, and hung up. Telling her father was horrible. When her therapist made her call him, he wanted her to come home right away, thinking she'd gotten pregnant at Collier. But she admitted that it had happened before she left Mullaby. Though he demanded to know who the father was, she never told him. In the end, everyone agreed that she should stay at Collier. She wasn't the only pregnant girl there, after all. She started craving cakes around her third month. The sensation was unbelievable. There were times she thought she would go crazy with it. Her therapist told her it was just a normal pregnancy craving, but Julia knew better. This child growing inside her obviously had Sawyer's magical sweet sense. When Julia couldn't get enough sweets during the day, she started sneaking out of her dorm to go to the cafeteria. That's where she baked her first cake. She became pretty good at it after a while, because it was the only thing that settled the baby. It had an unusual effect on the rest of the school, too. The smell of cake would slowly waft through the hallways while she baked at night, and girls in their dorm rooms, even the girls whose dreams were always dark, would suddenly dream of their kind-hearted grandmothers and long-ago birthday parties. Julia's therapist started talking to her about adoption options in her fifth month. She adamantly refused to consider it, but every session her therapist would ask, "How do you plan to care for this child on your own?" And Julia began to get scared. She didn't know how she was going to do it. Her only choice was her father, but when she brought it up, he immediately said no. Beverly didn't want a baby in the house. In the spring, in a flood of pain and fear so great she doubled over in French class, Julia went into labor. It came on so quickly that she actually gave birth in the ambulance on her way to the hospital. She could feel the baby's frustration, her impatience, as she maneuvered her way to freedom. And Julia couldn't stop her. As much as she wanted to, there was nothing she could do to keep this child physically bound to her any longer. Her daughter had a mind and an agenda, all her own. After it was over, the baby proceeded to fuss about how hard her journey had been to anyone who would listen, the way old ladies in tweed coats like to fuss about long, hot train rides into the city. It made Julia laugh, holding the squawking infant in her arms in the ambulance. She was perfect, with Sawyer's blonde hair and blue eyes. Julia's father came to Maryland to see her in the hospital the next day, and she asked him one last time to take her and the baby home. Standing at the foot of the hospital bed, his ball cap in his hands, looking shy and out of place, he again said no. She gave up on ever having a real relationship with her father after that. Nothing would ever be the same. It was the hardest decision Julia had ever made, giving up her little girl. Now that the baby was independent of Julia's body, she knew she couldn't take care of her alone. She could barely take care of herself. She hated Beverly for not wanting a baby in the house, and she hated her father for being so weak. But most of all, she hated Sawyer. If only he had loved her. If only he had been there to help her. Then she could have kept the baby. He was depriving her of the one person in the world who would ever need her completely, the only person in the world she knew she would love for the rest of her life. No questions, no limits. She was told that a couple from Washington, D.C. adopted the baby. Julia was given two photos. One was the official hospital photo. The other was of Julia in the hospital bed, holding her, warm and soft and smelling pink. Julia put the photos away immediately, because it hurt too much to look at them, only to find them years later in an old textbook when she was packing to move after college. It took a long, long time to feel fine again. She started cutting herself again not long after she was released from the hospital. Her school therapist worked tirelessly to get her admitted into a summer program sponsored by Collier because Julia wasn't ready to go home. Julia still felt too vulnerable to go back to Mullaby after the summer, so her father agreed that she should stay at Collier for her senior high school year. She applied to and was accepted to college the next year. Though she hadn't baked since she was pregnant, those months of practice made her proficient enough to get a job at a grocery store bakery to help her father pay for her college tuition. By this time, with the help of continued therapy sessions, Julia was able to think of Sawyer without the world turning a furious ember red around her, and she remembered what he'd told her about following the scent of his mother's cakes home. It became a symbol to her. Maybe, one day in the future, baking cakes would bring her daughter, who had a sweet sense, like her father, back to Julia. Then she would explain why she gave her up. At the very least, it would carry Julia's love to her, wherever she was. Nearly 20 years later, Julia was still calling out to her. Knowing she was out there in the world somewhere was what got Julia through every single day. She couldn't imagine a life without knowing that.
Sawyer was living that unimaginable life. It was then that she knew she had to tell him. She thought she'd been miserable here before. The next 6 months were going to be hell. Julia heard a light tapping at her door. She opened her eyes and was surprised to see that the sky was blackberry blue and the first star of the night was out. She got up and went to her bedroom doorway.
"Julia?" Stella called. "Julia, are you all right? You've been awfully quiet up here."
"Sawyer's gone, if that's what you're waiting for." There was a pause.
"Okay. I'll be downstairs if you need me. If you want to talk."
She heard Stella walk back down the stairs. Julia rested her head against the door jamb for a moment, then she walked into the hallway. She paused at the door to the stairs, then walked past it and into the kitchen. A hummingbird cake, she decided as she turned on the kitchen light. It was made with bananas and pineapples and pecans and had a cream cheese frosting. She would make it light enough to float away. She reached over to open the window, to float to her daughter. Chapter 10. The car had an 8-track player. The steering wheel was huge, like it should be on a boat. The interior smelled like cough drops, and she loved it. Emily loved this car. When Vance's mechanic dropped the car off the next day, she eagerly sat behind the wheel. But then she realized that she couldn't think of anywhere she wanted to go. The more she thought about it, the more she didn't really want to leave Mullaby. Although she would never say it out loud, she would never tell another living soul, there was a part of her now finding an odd comfort in her mother's fallibility. Dulcie had set an impossible standard in Boston, and Emily thought she could never do enough, care enough, work hard enough. And sometimes she'd resented it, which made her feel even worse. But it turns out that even Dulcie herself couldn't live up to that standard, at least not here. Emily sat in the car until it became too hot, then she got out. She couldn't go next door to visit, because Julia had left earlier. And she didn't want to go back inside her own house, because Grandpa Vance was taking a nap, and the new butterfly wallpaper in her room made her nervous. She would swear it moved sometimes, and she couldn't figure out how. She walked aimlessly to the back of the house. The yard was so overgrown that, at eye level, it was hard to even see the gazebo at the back of the property. Looking around, she was amazed that she'd come away with only a cut on her heel that night she'd chased the Mullaby lights. She hadn't seen the light in the woods since she'd come back from the lake, and she was a little disappointed. Making sense of at least one thing here would be nice. With nothing better to do, she began to pick up twigs and fallen limbs from the yard. She checked the garage for a lawnmower, but didn't find one. She did find some shears, though, and went to the gazebo and began to trim back the wild boxwood bushes, flustering a large frog who was hiding in the shade there. As she slowly worked her way around the gazebo, shortening the bushes so the posts and latticework could be seen, the fat frog followed her. At one point, she lobbed off a bit of boxwood, and a twig fell onto the frog. She laughed and bent to lift it off of him, and that's when she saw it. A large heart with the initials DS plus LC carved inside. It was carved onto a back post of the gazebo, near the bottom, just like on the tree at the lake. Her fingers reached out to trace the lines of the heart. Logan Coffey had been in this backyard. She didn't know why her eyes went to the woods, just a hunch, but there, on one of the trees that formed the border into the woods, was another carving, DS plus LC. She set the shears down on the steps of the gazebo and went to it. The frog followed her for a few steps, then stopped. She saw another heart farther in the woods, then another. They formed a trail, too irresistible not to follow. Every 3 or 4 trees, there was a heart with the initials inside. Some of them were harder to find than others, and she spent at least 15 minutes slowly making her way through the woods until she finally broke into a clearing. This was exactly the same place the light had led her
the night she'd chased it. The park on Main Street. She looked over to the bandstand, and there, carved into the base of the structure, next to the side steps, was the heart with the initials. She walked to the bandstand and knelt, touching the carving. Why did they lead here? Did they have something to do with her mother leading Logan Coffey onto the bandstand stage that night? She stood again and looked around the park. It was full of people that day. Some were having lunch, some were sunbathing. A couple of people were playing frisbee with their dogs. And then there was Wynn Coffey. He was standing with a few adults in the middle of the park. One of the men was the big man from the party at the lake. She didn't realize it before, but he was clearly related to Wynn, if the dark hair, the summer linen suit, and the bow tie were any indication. The adults were gesturing toward the street, to the large festival banner being erected, but Wynn's head was turned the other way, looking at her. Without thinking, she ducked behind the bandstand. Then she immediately regretted it. What was the matter with her? In a small town, it was inevitable that they would run into each other. But she didn't want him to think she was following him. Not that hiding as soon as she saw him helped that impression. She waited a few minutes before she straightened her shoulders and walked back around the bandstand. It was a public park. She had as much a right to be there as he did. As soon as she came around from the back, she gave an exclamation of surprise. There he was, facing her. He was leaning one shoulder against the side of the bandstand, his hands in his trouser pockets.
"Are you hiding from me?" he asked.
"No," she said quickly. "I mean, I didn't know you'd be here. I didn't even know I'd be here. I was just following a trail of these from the back of my grandfather's house." She pointed to the carving. Without moving, he lowered his eyes to the heart.
"They're all over town. After my uncle died, my grandfather tried to scratch over all of them until he realized there were too many around, more than he'd probably ever find."
"Dulcie Shelby and Logan Coffey. That's what they mean?" He nodded. Despite what everyone thinks of her, she wasn't this person, she found herself saying as she indicated the carving again. Not when she left.
"I know," he said. When she raised her brows, he shrugged. "I googled her name the day after we met. I found out a lot about her. I read about the school she helped found in Boston, and I saw your photo on the school's website."
That made her cheeks feel like she'd bitten into a green apple. She hoped it wasn't the photo of her at the Christmas food drive. She looked constipated in that photo, yet it was always the one they used in the school literature. When Emily had protested, her mother had said, "Don't be vain. What you look like doesn't matter. It's the deed that matters." Emily used to think her mother had no idea what it was like to be a teenager.
"You know a lot more about me than I know about you," Emily finally said. "I don't think that's fair."
Wynn leaned in toward her, making her heart do a strange kick. His eyes went to her lips, and she suddenly wondered if he was going to kiss her. The crazy thing was, despite everything, there was a tiny part of her that wanted him to.
"Does this mean you're curious?" he asked.
"Yes," she said, honestly, swallowing. "Especially about why coming out at night caused your uncle to commit suicide. My mother might not have been a very nice person here, but what kind of secret is that to kill yourself over?" She didn't realize what she'd said until he suddenly pulled back and gave her an assessing look.
"You've learned a few things since we last talked."
"My grandfather said he didn't tell me because he thought I was better off not knowing. He's not thrilled that you took it upon yourself to be my tour guide into my mother's past."
"And how do you feel?"
"I still love my mom." He hesitated, as if this was a side effect of his actions he hadn't intended.
"I wasn't trying to make you feel otherwise. I'm sorry. I was just trying to help."
Something made her wonder if he meant to help her or help himself. "Why was it such a big deal to be seen at night?" she suddenly asked. "I mean, you come out at night now, don't you?"
"No."
"No?" she asked, surprised. "Why?"
You wouldn't believe me if I told you.
You've said that before. How do you know?
He gave her a look that made every nerve in her body feel alive, like when someone comes up behind you and startles you. There's a small, sudden twitch, a quick gasp of air.
Be careful what you wish for, he said.
Wynn, what are you doing back here?
The man dressed like Wynn suddenly appeared from around the front of the bandstand. He was bulky, but not fat, as if his own importance made him take up so much room. He smelled of cigars and sweet laundry starch. He looked at Wynn, who tightened like a rope knot, with clear animosity. The man's eyes fell on Emily.
Ah,
he said, as if something suddenly made sense.
You must be Emily Benedict.
Yes. He gave her a politician's smile, lots of teeth, but it didn't quite make it to his eyes.
I'm Morgan Coffey, mayor of Mullaby, and Wynn's father. I believe I saw you at my daughter's party last Saturday. I don't recall you being invited.
I didn't know I needed an invitation. I apologize.
Well, then.
He held out his hand, and she shook it. His grip was bone-crushing.
Welcome to town.
Thank you, she said, trying to draw her hand back.
But he held on, lifting her arm slightly, his eyes on the silver charm bracelet she was wearing.
Where did you get this?
He demanded. With another tug, she slid her hand out of his and hid the bracelet with her other hand.
It was my mother's.
Morgan Coffey looked completely poleaxed.
My father gave that to my mother when they got married.
Emily shook her head. Surely he was mistaken. Maybe they just look the same.
The moon charm has an inscription. Yours, from dark to light.
Emily didn't have to look. The words had almost been rubbed off, but they were still there. She could feel tears come to her eyes.
I'm sorry, she said, fumbling as she took it off. She held the bracelet out to him, her heart breaking. She must have stolen it.
After what she'd learned about her mother, she wouldn't put it past her. A muscle twitched at his jawline.
She didn't steal it. Wynn, let's go.
Morgan Coffey turned and left without another word, without taking the bracelet. Wynn watched him go, then said to Emily,
That went better than I thought it would, actually.
She looked away, blinking back tears.
I don't think I want to know how you thought it would go.
He smiled and stepped over to her. He took the bracelet, which she was still holding out in her palm, and put it back on her wrist. His touch was warm, and it seemed greater than him, somehow, like she could feel it beyond the places he actually touched. And there again was that comforting feeling. She took a deep breath, her tears disappearing. How did he do that? Make her feel so wary, and yet so fond of him. He looked up from fastening the bracelet and met her eyes. He was still touching her wrist, and she was trembling with the effort to remain still.
Will I see you at the festival this weekend?
Julia had asked her, but Emily hadn't given her an answer yet. But she had the answer now.
Yes.
Friends?
He asked, and it sounded like he was asking her to do something perilous. He made her feel brave for standing there, for facing him, and she didn't know why. She'd never felt brave before, not like this, like there were choices she could finally make on her own. She nodded.
Friends.
When Sawyer pulled into his driveway after work that day, he saw Julia sitting on the front steps of his townhouse, a white cake box on her lap. It never occurred to him that she knew where he lived. It made him feel important to her, somehow. Though that was probably his delusion speaking. It spoke to him often about Julia. But this explained the black pickup truck he saw parked at the curb a couple of blocks away. As he'd passed it, he'd thought it looked like Julia's, though he had no idea why she chose to park so far away. He wondered if she didn't want to be seen associating with him. He stopped in front of his garage and cut the engine. He stepped out of his Lexus, bringing his briefcase with him. He'd been looking at potential rental properties that day. His family's property management business was slowly expanding into neighboring counties. His father had been against it at first. For a very long time, their only client had been the Coffeys, who owned most of the rental property in Mullaby. It had been a constant battle with his father to get him to even entertain the idea of taking on other properties to manage. Now business was so good they were considering opening a satellite office. As he approached her, Julia stood. She was wearing blue jeans and a dark blue peasant blouse, the ties of the neck open. She looked so beautiful and soft, with her big brown eyes and her light brown hair shining in the afternoon light. He couldn't see the pink streak, and he had an incredible urge to find it. He'd always been fascinated by her, drawn to her the way curious people are always drawn to things they don't understand. But he'd done a spectacular job of ruining any chance he'd ever had of being with her, and he'd done it at the amazing age of 16. Truly, he should get an award or something. World's longest regret. The night he and Julia had had was amazing, and something he'd dreamed about for years. Up until that night, she'd only been a fantasy. He'd been the popular preppy kid, she'd been the school's punk hard ass. He'd never thought he'd have a chance with her, so he'd kept his distance and watched her from afar. That night was everything he'd dreamed it would be, although a little bittersweet. He'd meant, absolutely, everything he'd said at the time, all caught up in the fantasy come true. But adolescence is like having only enough light to see the step directly in front of you, and no farther. When Julia had left for school the next day, he'd gotten scared. He and Holly had the approval of not only his parents and hers, but everyone in school. Especially after what had happened with Dulcie and Logan that same summer, how the whole town had turned on her and looked suspiciously at her friends, he'd wanted to hold on to what he had, and he didn't have Julia. Julia was water in his hands. She'd slipped right through. Lovely and strange and unpredictable, she'd been everything he wasn't, nothing he was used to. He'd reacted badly when she'd called him and told him she was pregnant. When he thought back to that conversation, it was like watching a movie. It was the only way he could deal with it. To totally disassociate. That wasn't him. That was a ghost of himself. Some horrible boy who'd forced a troubled girl to have an abortion because he hadn't wanted to face the consequences of his actions. But he ended up facing the consequences anyway. Fate has a way of biting you in the ass like that. He thought he'd moved on, first with Holly, then by throwing himself into the family business. But then Julia came back to town. And he realized for the first time that he hadn't moved on at all. He'd just been waiting, waiting for her to come back and forgive him.
"I didn't know you knew where I lived," he said as he walked up the steps toward her. "Apparently I didn't. Someone told me once that you owned a big house on Gatliff Street. I assumed you lived there, but Stella told me that's where you and Holly lived when you were together, and that you'd moved here after the divorce." "Holly and I still own that house jointly, actually."
He stopped on the porch and stood in front of her.
"When she moved to Raleigh, we agreed to rent it out and split the income."
"Why didn't you just keep living there?"
"It was too big. My family gave it to us as a wedding gift. 5 bedrooms. It was a big hint for grandchildren."
"Oh," Julia said awkwardly.
"Don't be embarrassed. I'm not. I've come to terms with it."
She gave him a look that said she didn't believe him. Then, changing the subject, she thrust the cake box at him. "I brought you a hummingbird cake," she said. "I made it last night." He set down his briefcase and took the box from her, stunned.
"You actually baked me a cake?"
"Don't get all emotional on me. I have to tell you something. A couple of things, actually. I'll save the big thing for later." Later. That was curious. And encouraging. He couldn't help it. Later meant there would be time in between, time to be with her.
"And the cake is to soften me up?"
"The cake is because I know you like it." He gestured toward the door.
"Come in," he said, suddenly excited by the thought of her being in his house.
It was almost as if, By having her step over the threshold, something significant would be accomplished. She would be closer to him. He would be closer to her forgiveness. But she shook her head. I can't. I ran out of gas coming over here.
Ah, that's why I saw your truck parked a couple of blocks away.
She nodded. I was just waiting for you to come home to give you this and to tell you something. Then I have to walk to the gas station.
I can take you.
I'll be fine, she said dismissively. She didn't want anything from him. Yet he wanted so much from her. I do bake cakes because of you. Well, I started baking cakes because of you. That's what I wanted to tell you.
He wasn't expecting that. He rocked back slightly on his heels.
She stuffed her hands deep into her jeans pockets, making her shoulders hunch a little. It's what you told me about how you always sensed when your mother baked cakes. I loved that story. I started baking when I was away at school. That's a whole story unto itself. The point is, at a time in my life when there were a lot of bad things happening, you gave me something good, something to hold on to. I'm opening my own bakery when I move back to Baltimore. And it all started with you.
He felt incredibly humbled. She was being too generous.
I didn't give you anything but a hard time.
How can you possibly appreciate that? I've learned to hold on to the good parts.
He didn't know what to say. He struggled for a few moments before saying,
And that's not even the big thing?
She smiled.
No. On the one hand, he really wanted to know. On the other, he wanted to make this last. As curious as he was, he would live with the anticipation forever if it meant being able to be with her like this. He shifted the cake box and opened it. He loved hummingbird cake. It was all he could do not to dig his hand through it like a shovel right now. His mother had tried to hide cakes from him when he was small, but he always found them. He couldn't help it. At that age, he hadn't yet developed the willpower to resist. He'd inherited his sweet sense from his grandfather. It was the reason he felt so close to him, closer than to anyone else in his family. His grandfather had been the one who taught him how to turn it off after one too many stomach aches, and he'd also been the one who'd told Sawyer that not everyone could see what he saw, so be careful who he told. Sawyer normally left it off now, unless he was distracted or tired. Then he would unwittingly see the silver glitter undulating out of house windows or the sparkle trailing out of a child's lunchbox. The only time he consciously switched it on was when Julia baked on Thursday nights. She was hidden from him, but he could see her do this. She was so good at it, the smell so beautiful. And he'd inspired it. He was overwhelmed.
You're the only person I've ever told about my sweet sense, he said.
He'd never even told his ex-wife. I hate to break this to you, but your secret is out. He closed the lid to the box before temptation got the better of him. He shook his head.
Uh-uh, that's not going to work anymore. You can be as hard and sarcastic as you want, but we both know you really have a soft spot for me. You just admitted it.
If you tell anyone, I'll deny it.
Come on, he said, feeling as light as high cotton. I'll take you to your truck. I think I even have some gas in a canister in my garage.
But he had already grabbed his briefcase and was walking down the steps. By the time he had the cake and his briefcase in the back seat of the car and the gas canister full of gas in the trunk, she was in the driveway, looking uncomfortable and ridiculously lovely. He opened the passenger side door for her, and she sighed and got in. When Sawyer got behind the wheel and started the car, she busied herself by playing with his navigation system. He just smiled when she programmed his GPS to take them to Frank's Toilet World on the highway. Instead of Toilet World, in a matter of minutes, he was at her truck. They both got out, and he put the gas from the canister into her tank. She thanked him, but before she could get in, he said impulsively, "Have dinner with me tonight." She shook her head. "That's not a good idea."
"Come on. You have 6 months left here. Live a little."
She snorted. "Are you seriously asking me to have a fling with you?"
"Absolutely not," he said, feigning shock. I said dinner. It was your lascivious mind that went to the bedroom.
She smiled, and he was glad. This was much better than the bristles she'd given him since coming back. Without thinking, he lifted his hand to her hair, petting it, then threading his fingers through it so that he could see the pink streak. He often wondered why she kept it. It had to have something to do with her pink hair when she was a teenager. Was it her way of remembering? Or maybe it was her reminder to never go back. When he met her eyes, he was stunned to see that they were huge. They darted once to his lips. She thought he was going to kiss her. And she wasn't running away. Suddenly, his blood was pumping thickly, increasing in a steady rhythm until it was roaring in his ears, and he leaned down and put his lips to hers. Touching her, kissing her, was everything he remembered. There was such chemistry between them. Christ, he could almost feel it, the break in her exterior. She'd just let him in. It was that effortless. He remembered from the football field how willingly she had given herself to him, how it had felt like this. And he remembered thinking at the time, this girl must be in love with me. He lifted his lips from hers, startled. I have to go, she said, quickly, not meeting his eyes, obviously embarrassed. Thank you for the gas. She wrenched open the door to her truck and jumped in. He was still standing on the sidewalk, long after she drove away.
What just happened here? He thought. What in the hell just happened?
Chapter 11. Long ago, and mostly forgotten, the land surrounding Mullaby was once farmland, hogland. In those hard-scrabble days of North Carolina, when cattle refused to thrive, swine farming was a boon to the state. Like the citizens of many small towns in the area, the people of Mullaby took great pride in the slow, meticulous pit cooking of pork, and it soon became an important part of defining who they were. It was at first a Sunday tradition, then a symbol of community, and eventually an art form, the art of old North Carolina, an art born out of work so hard it could fell a hearty man. But as the years passed, the small farms and the once prosperous hog trade trails that stretched into Tennessee gradually disappeared. Up cropped neighborhoods and shopping centers, and then the interstate came, taking away people who remembered and bringing in people who didn't. Eventually, the origin and the reasons fell away from the bone, and all that was left was a collective unconscious, a tradition without a memory, a dream every person in the town of Mullaby had on the same date every year. In the early hours of the morning, on the day of the Mullaby Barbecue Festival, a fog would settle low in the air, sneaking into windows and into nighttime visions. "You'll forget when you wake," it would whisper, "but know this now. And be proud. This is your history." Stella had been gone for hours before Julia finally left the house. Stella considered the festival her day of debauchery. She started early and wouldn't be home until the next day. Sometimes Julia worried about her. She couldn't help it. She'd gotten to know Stella well in the past year and a half. Julia had never seen anyone try so hard to be happy with what she had. The Stella that Julia knew now was very different from the Stella she'd known in high school. Back then, Stella had been conspicuously showy, just like Dulcie Shelby. They'd been as thick as thieves. She'd driven a shiny black BMW, bought specifically to match her shiny black hair. And Julia remembered hearing about how Stella's decorator mother, who lived in Raleigh while Stella lived in Mullaby with her father, had designed Stella's bedroom to look like a movie theater, complete with her own private movie screen and a popcorn machine. It had even been featured in some design magazine. To be honest, when Julia came back, she'd been surprised to find Stella still living here. Julia had always imagined those rich girls from school going on to live exotic lives. They'd had everything. Every opportunity. When you had that much, why would you squander it? How could you accept anything less? Stella's problem, it turned out, was falling for the wrong guy, a tale as old as time. Her ex-husband had done a number on her by cheating and spending his way through her trust fund. The experience had turned Stella into a funny, self-deprecating woman who worked in a flower shop, lived in a house she could barely afford, and drank wine out of a box. Sometimes Julia wondered if Stella wanted it all back, if she would trade all she'd learned to be that envied girl again. Julia had never asked. Their pasts were touchy subjects, which was why Julia hadn't told her about Sawyer and the kiss, even though she really wanted to. And the fact that she couldn't bring herself to tell something that personal to Stella meant that they weren't as close as Stella thought they were. It made her sad, though she couldn't figure out why. Julia didn't want to get close to anyone here. Her real life was back in Baltimore. It was noon when Julia finally walked over to Vance's house to take Emily to the Mullaby Barbecue Festival. She knocked on the door and heard Emily race down the staircase with uncharacteristic enthusiasm. Julia was instantly suspicious. Emily ran outside, and Vance followed shortly.
"Are you sure you won't come with us?"
Emily asked her grandfather, almost hopping from one foot to the other.
"I'm sure," Vance said. "You two have fun."
Julia and Vance watched as Emily ran down the front porch steps. "I'll have her back before dark," Julia told Vance, "and we'll bring you some festival treats."
"That's right nice of you, Julia." "She seems awfully excited, doesn't she?" Vance said as Emily disappeared under the trees.
"Yes," Julia said, thoughtfully. "She does."
"Getting excited about barbecue. She's a lot like me."
He paused, then seemed to reconsider.
"I mean, there's not a lot about me I'd want her to favor, but..."
Julia put her hand on his arm. "She is a lot like you, Vance, and that's a good thing." When Julia met her on the sidewalk, Emily asked, "Why won't he come? He loves barbecue." "Vance tries to stay away from crowds," Julia said as they walked toward downtown.
"I guess I've gotten so used to it that I forget sometimes."
"You're fitting in more than you think, then."
"So how are the two of you getting along?"
Emily shrugged, distracted.
"Okay, I guess. Better."
"That's good." Once they reached Main Street, Julia could tell that Emily was a little taken aback. First-timers usually were. Most people assumed that because Mullaby was small, the festival would be small as well. But the Mullaby Barbecue Festival was actually the largest barbecue festival in the Southeast, and it attracted people from all over the country. The street was closed to cars, and white tents stretched as far as the eye could see. In the distance, the top of a Ferris wheel could be seen. The smell was intense and delicious, like being in an oven. As they wove their way through the crowded street, they passed numerous barbecue tents, the focus of the festival, after all. Inside the tents, the barbecue sandwiches were made in an assembly line. Sauce, no sauce, coleslaw in your sandwich, want hush puppies in a cup with that? The sandwiches could be seen in the hands of every other person on the street, half wrapped in foil. There were also tents selling pork rinds and boiled corn on the cob, chicken on a stick, and brats, fried pickles and fried candy bars, and, of course, funnel cakes. Craft tents dotted the area, too.
"I didn't know it would be this big,"
Emily said, her head swinging around, trying to take it all in.
"How do you find anyone in all of this?"
"Looking for someone in particular?" Julia asked. Emily hesitated.
"No, not really."
But to test her theory, Julia purposely led Emily to the main stage. There were several stages staggered around the festival where bands were playing, folk and bluegrass mostly, but the main stage was right in the middle of Main Street. Crowds had to break around it like water. There was a group of people, most of them coffees, clustered at the bottom of the stage steps, the men in hats and the women in crisp, belted dresses. Wynne was wearing a straw boater hat, which would have looked ridiculous on anyone else his age. Sure enough, Emily's eyes went right to him, and he seemed to know exactly when it happened, because he looked up and saw her. Neither of them moved toward each other, but their intense awareness was almost palpable.
"Why is Wynne... why are the coffees so dressed up?" Emily asked. "I mean, more than usual."
"Because this festival belongs to them. Their family created it as an annual event about 60 years ago. It's their baby. In a little while, they'll do all their grandstanding on that stage. Then they'll judge some barbecue and pie contests. Wynn's father looked over to his son, then followed his stare. He immediately called Wynn over to him, at the same time Julia ushered Emily away. She and Emily had a good time for the next few hours. They ate way too much and bought commemorative T-shirts that read, "I went hog wild at the Mullaby Barbecue Festival." It was a splurge Julia could hardly afford. She allotted herself very little spending money because she wanted as much as possible to go toward the restaurant's mortgage, but it was worth it. Julia hadn't been to the festival in years. Her restaurant had a tent here somewhere. She didn't have anything to do with it. Her managers had set it all up. She remembered how her father had loved the festival, and there had been a time when Julia had loved to come with him. She thought the event had lost its appeal for her, but she liked seeing it through Emily's eyes. For the first time in a long time, she realized she actually missed something about this place. Tired and sweaty and happy, they finally reached the amusement park rides at the other end of the street. It was getting late, so their plan was to go on a few rides, get snow cones for themselves and treats for Vance, then go home. But that's when Sawyer appeared, in khakis and a polo, winding his way toward them. Julia would have quickly steered Emily away and lost him if Emily hadn't seen him first and said, "There's Sawyer!" as if he were a rare and colorful bird they had to stand still to watch. No one could deny that he was a sight to behold, but the muscles in her shoulders bunched and tightened as he approached. She'd been purposely avoiding him since last Tuesday, trying to devise a plan. She didn't know what to do without her animosity toward him. It had been her constant companion for years, and now that he'd broken through that, now that she'd made the decision to tell him about what had really happened all those years ago, she felt too vulnerable. She was walking a high wire without a net, and that kiss proved just how easily she could fall. As he walked toward them, he gave Julia a look so hot she was almost embarrassed. Contrary to this look, however, the first words out of his mouth were, "I hope you're happy. My navigation system has been trying to take me to Frank's toilet world all week." Emily laughed, and Julia said, "Sorry." "I get the feeling you like pointing me in the wrong direction." Before she could respond, he turned to Emily and said, "Are you having a good time?"
"We've had a great day," Emily said.
"We won't be staying much longer," Julia added. "We were about to take in a few rides, then go home." He chose to interpret that as an invitation rather than a brush-off. Sawyer had never been good with rejection. It happened so rarely to him.
"Great. Then I'll join you."
"We don't want to keep you," Julia said. "Surely you're here with someone."
"I came alone, if that's what you're asking. I met up with Stella earlier, but then her entourage got too big. Stella is like a comet collecting space debris as she passes."
That made Emily laugh again, but Julia, more curious than she wanted to be ever since Sawyer had told her he'd once slept with Stella, asked seriously, "You didn't want to be a part of Stella's comet tail?"
"I was suddenly distracted by another heavenly body," he said, meeting her eyes.
Emily cleared her throat.
"I'm sure you two want to be alone. Why don't you go on a ride together? I'd like to walk around by myself for a while, anyway."
Julia tore her eyes off Sawyer. "I don't think that's a good idea, Em," she said, and actually put a hand on her shoulder, trying to keep her there.
"Why not?"
Emily asked.
"Yes, Julia," Sawyer said, smiling. "Why not?"
"Because I told your grandfather I'd keep an eye on you."
"I'll be fine."
"But, Julia," Emily said reasonably, "I'm 17, not 4. Julia knew she wasn't going to win this one. "Meet me by the bandstand in 1 hour." 1 hour. Emily kissed Julia's cheek. It was an unexpected gesture from her, a sweet, daughterly thing to do.
"Thanks."
1 hour, Julia called after her as she watched the crowd swallow Emily.
She had an overwhelming urge to drag her back, to protect her from everything that had hurt her so much as a teenager. She finally turned back to Sawyer, who had his brows raised. "She's been looking for an excuse to get away from me. Wynn Coffey has been eyeing her all afternoon, and I've seen her watching him."
"It was inevitable," Sawyer said. "Those two were going to have magnets attached to each other, no matter what. The lure of the forbidden."
"I don't want her to get hurt. She's been through so much already."
"You really care about her, don't you?" "Nothing has happened yet, and Wynn is a pretty good kid. But if he does hurt her, he'll have me to contend with." "Now," he said, leaning in slightly, putting his face close to hers, "let's talk about last Tuesday."
"I have a better idea," she said. "Let's go in the fun house instead." Sawyer looked confused. She couldn't blame him.
"That's a better idea?"
"It's the fun house. Who doesn't love the fun house?" she said as she walked over to the small structure. It sounded ridiculous, even to her, but talking about last Tuesday was too far ahead of her plans. He wanted her. She'd known that since she came back. But there was the little matter of telling him about their daughter first. That was going to change everything. Sawyer followed her and bought their tickets. When they entered, the undulating floor threw her off balance, and she fell back against him. He took her hand and pulled her across the room. Many kids chose to stay in that room and ride the wooden waves, so when Julia and Sawyer tripped into the Hall of Mirrors, they were the only ones there. She had to hold out her hands to make her way forward. Which was the walkway, and which was just reflection? Which was the real Julia? She turned quickly when Sawyer disappeared from behind her. "Where did you go?" she called.
"I'm not sure," he called back.
She turned and tried to follow his voice. She almost walked into a mirror, then followed the corner of that mirror to the corridor she'd thought he'd taken. The strobe lights didn't help. It was like they were in a psychedelic ice cave, and the frantic music in the room sounded like a heartbeat.
"If you want me to say I'm sorry for kissing you, I will," Sawyer said.
She caught sight of him. Then he disappeared again.
"But I won't mean it. I'm sorry for a lot of things, but not that."
There. There he was again. No, he moved. "Stand still so I can find you," she said. "I don't want you..."